Mitch is about men's health.
Okay, okay.
It's on their record.
All right.
Sorry that I was talking for so long.
No, that's quite all right.
Next time I'll be more comedic.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's November 18th, 2015, live here in House Room, Hearing Room F, okay? And it happens to be 10 minutes, 11 minutes after 2 o'clock, and we're opening up the House Interim Committee and Judiciary.
And also good morning or afternoon, whichever you might be, depending on where you're at, since our chair of the House Committee may actually be still mourning where he's at.
That's true.
I know he's probably following us every statement we make, but we're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary as well. Everyone, thank you very much for being here.
So,
all right, so what we're having today are 4 different areas that we're going to be discussing, if I'm not mistaken. Those 4 areas, we're going to go a little bit out of order because of needs for some of our members. So informational hearings are today, and what those are basically for are invited testimony. This is not for public testimony per se, but this will be information that we have. And if any of these concepts are going to be moving forward during the next session that's scheduled in February of 2016, clearly we'll be having public hearings where individuals will be able to give comments once we have whatever is defined as a bill for consideration. So with that, we'll start with our first informational hearing. That's going to be invitation to our local public safety coordinator council, What Works in Public Safety Conference, and Judy Shiprack and Paul Egbert are going to be our presenters. Judy, thank you for being here. Paul, thank you as well. And y'all both have been here before, so if you would be so kind to give us your name prior to your testimony, that would be wonderful.
Tell us what you want.
Thank you very much. What a delight. I think that first, my name is Judy Shiprack, and I serve as the co-chair of Multnomah County's Public Safety Coordinating Council. I am the elected commissioner for District Number 3 for another year. Sorry, is that an inside joke? I thought it was. I thought everyone
was there somewhere.
And I really appreciate the invitation. Co-chairs Olson and Prozanski have both, you've both been tremendous supporters of the What Works Conference, which really got started, I think, out of my longing to still be of service to the legislature. And I've been involved with the What Works Conference for 10 years now. And during those 10 years, there have been significant changes, improvements, opportunities in the public safety world. And you know, you've participated in many of them. And I really feel that it is a partnership between the counties and the legislature. Our annual What Works Conference has played an important role in all of these conversations. It's an all-day invitation-only event where public safety practitioners and policymakers from across Oregon, including legislators, and frankly targeted to legislators, are able to hear from local and nationally recognized experts in the field of public safety. And just for example, in recent years, we've been honored to host some distinguished figures, including Dr. Robert Anda, the co-author of the groundbreaking Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which we know as ACEs, Robert Listenby, who's the administrator of the United States Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and Pete Early, the best-selling author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. The What Works Conference is a unique forum where individuals across our state are able to gather in one place and learn the newest cutting-edge public safety policies, exchange ideas, and network with each other. Our upcoming 2016 What Works Conference will address one of the more exciting public safety developments in recent years. Again, you've been major participants in this culture shift from an environment which sort of relishes a reputation of tough on crime to an environment and culture that's smart on crime. Lawmakers across the country from all political backgrounds have begun to realize our over-reliance on incarceration that has not worked. The legislature and local governments across Oregon have been leaders in many of these areas, and I thank you for your leadership. Speakers at the 2016 conference, which will be held here in Salem and which is co-sponsored by Council on Criminal Justice Commission, thank you. Presenters will include Eileen Gary, who is Deputy Director of the Bureau of Justice Assistance, the Honorable Eric Block, Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge, Dr. Douglas B. Marlowe, Chief of Science, Law, and Policy for the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, and the Honorable Ann Aiken, Chief Judge for the U.S. District Court of Oregon. And by the way, who I know because in a former life, she was the Clerk of the House of Representatives for the State of Oregon. In my former life, I suppose, in her former life as well. So as a county commissioner and a former legislator, I'm really aware of our need to put our heads together, that we need to have opportunities where we can discover new ways to improve the work that we all do. So we carve out this time. We have opportunities to listen to experts talk about what works, in this case, in public safety. So thank you so much for this invitation. And I have printed invitations to you, as well as the ones I'm sure you've received online. If you haven't, my apologies, you should have. And I see that your amazing staff is coming down to pick these up.
Thank you. Paul, why don't you go ahead and give us your statements, and then we'll open up for discussion. Thank you.
Paul Egbert from the Criminal Justice Commission. I'm the operations manager. And CJC has had a long history as a co-sponsor of this event, and it serves as our annual LIPSIC event, which we have responsibility to provide technical assistance and help to the LIPSICs. This particular upcoming What Works conference will be talking about assessment in part, which is clearly aligned to justice reinvestment. We've found that justice reinvestment has revitalized a number of LIPSICs around the state and provided more activity and opportunity to work together locally. So we're excited about the upcoming event and look forward to it and our ongoing sponsorship and with it.
Thank you. Questions from anyone up here on the dais as to the program or the conference that is on, will be coming in, looks like January 14th of 2016. Thank you all very much for coming forward. Appreciate your time. So we're going to go ahead and close that informational hearing. We're now going to go ahead and open up a second informational hearing. This is going to be the review of physical injury definition. We have currently scheduled as invited testimony Senator Montes Anderson. Senator Montes Anderson, if you'd like to maybe start off, and then we'll ask the next two presenters to come after that.
Great. Thank you, Chair Prozanski and Vice Chairs Olson and Leininger. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham Troptow Wood Village, Fairview, and I'm honored to be before you to speak on a topic that is very dear to my heart, as I'm sure it is to many of you on the committee. Last session, I was chief sponsor of Senate Bill 526, which would have updated the definition of physical injury. And we got parts of that bill put in other bills, but the physical injury needed a little bit more work. And so the problem still exists. And what the bill intended to do was remedy, we've sought remedies, and victims who cannot speak for themselves are really not being given adequate protection under the law as it exists today. There's a serious gap in the law with regards to the most vulnerable, and this is where the proposed legislation for 2016 will differ from 2015, where I think it was at the recommendation of Chair Prozanski to maybe narrow it to focus on the vulnerable populations. Many of you heard the testimony last session regarding the case of State versus Wright. In that case, there was an 18-month-old child who was beaten by a caretaker to the point that his entire back was bruised, and the pictures were horrific. Despite this, the state was unable to prove that physical injury had occurred. And this is just a direct result of the gap in our current definition in state law, and this needs to be changed. I'm joined today by esteemed DAs from Crook County, Multnomah County, and Washington County, and we have worked very closely together on this issue. They work with child abuse, elder abuse, and domestic violence. So they are here, and they're going to be outlining the problems to you and prosecuting these incredibly serious crimes. And at the end, we'll put forward our proposal to make certain that we can protect the most vulnerable persons in our community. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
All right. Any questions for the senator? All right. Thank you very much for coming forward. Yes. So I'm going to go ahead and ask our next two presenters to please come forward. Donna Vittles and Gina Skinner. While they're coming to the table, I do want to just put something out for this presentation. I believe that we are going to have physical injury photographs that are going to be made available for the dais for the members. I want to make certain that everyone understand that during this hearing, while we have this testimony coming in and some of these exhibits, as you can imagine, they're going to be very compelling as to some of the significance of the injuries. The presenters will, in fact, provide these to us here at the dais for us to review. We have had this happen before, and what we've decided is that it's in respect for the victims of these matters to not publish them onto OLIS. What that means is that we will retain them. Copies will be part of the official record, but they will be kept with the Judiciary Council. And if anyone who is in the general public want to seek to review those photos, they will have that opportunity through that process. But instead of putting them out onto an OLIS system that will put them statewide into perpetuity, the chair of this committee, and previously we have agreed that this was a better approach. So we will meet our requirements for open records, but at the same time we're going to respect the privacy of the victims that have been impacted by these tragic situations.
Thank you.
Ladies, if you'd like to get us started.
Chair Prozanski, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vittelins, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association and as Crook County District Attorney. Thank you very much, members, all the members of the committee, for allowing us this opportunity, and Senator Mona Sanderson as well, to talk about an issue that is protecting vulnerable victims. We are asking that the definition of physical injury be amended so that those who intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly hurt vulnerable victims are held accountable. Currently, in order to prove physical injury, we must prove either substantial pain or impairment of a physical condition. The Court of Appeals in the Supreme Court basically said that substantial pain must be ample or considerable pain, and impairment of a physical condition must be a reduction of one's ability to use the body or a bodily organ for less than a protected period of time. To give you some case examples from physical injury, in State versus Anderson, a 2-year-old was in a car when a defendant started to argue with his girlfriend. He broke the, punched the car window, shattered the glass, and the child was injured. He had, when officers responded, he had dried blood on his arm, a small cut, and a puncture wound on his foot. The defendant at the trial court was convicted of assault 4. The Court of Appeals reversed, saying that cuts did not impair his physical condition, and there was no evidence that he suffered substantial pain because he simply said owie at the time that he received the cuts. In State versus Reynolds, the police responded to a 911 call reporting screams coming from the victim's apartment. The defendant at the time was under a no-contact order with the victim. He kicked her multiple times and bruised her legs, and it lasted for several days. Again, the defendant was convicted at the trial court level of assault in the fourth degree. The Court of Appeals reversed and said, although the bruises lasted many days, that was not substantial pain. In State versus Wright, Senator Montes Anderson spoke about a child was beaten by a care provider, and there were black and purple bruises covering his back and left buttock. The doctor next day who saw the child reported that he seemed active and appeared to be in no pain. At the trial court level, the care provider was convicted of criminal mistreatment. And at the Court of Appeals level, the court said that the bruises did not cause impairment of physical condition. There was, the state did not put forward in this case substantial pain, but the Court of Appeals did opine in this case that substantial pain probably would not have worked either in light of the fact that the doctor said the next day the child seemed to be okay and seemed to be in no pain. And so at this point, I'm gonna show you the pictures from that State versus Wright case, which were fairly graphic. They took him out. I apologize. Okay, you said that. I apologize. So State versus Lewis, the defendant was the victim was the wife of the defendant. The defendant pulled out clumps of her hair. She was heard to say ouch and stop it at the time. And at trial, again, the defendant was convicted of assault four. And the Court of Appeals reversed again, saying there was no substantial pain here because the victim didn't say at trial that it was substantial pain. They found that there was nothing more than a fleeting sensation and that you could not infer substantial pain from that. The court also found in that case that there was no impairment of a physical condition because although she had clumps of hair ripped out, it did not impair the ordinary function of the skin, which is to protect from infection. So the Court of Appeals held no physical injury in that case. I'm going to now turn it over to Deputy District Attorney Skinner to continue.
Thank you, Senator, Chair Senator Posansky, Vice Chairman, Representative Olson, Vice Chairman, Representative Leininger, and Vice Chairman Senator Cruz, and other members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing us today. Just very briefly, my name is Gina Skinner, and I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Washington County, representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. I have been Deputy District Attorney for over 18 years, focusing on these types of crimes, and want to emphasize some of the reasons behind why it is really important to articulate the reasons for the proposed change in this legislation. What we're trying to do is take the current definition of physical injury, which requires the two elements that were previously articulated, either substantial pain or impairment of your physical condition, and add a subset so that victims who we are identifying as vulnerable victims will have an objective standard to be able to prove in court that they, in fact, were injured. So what is a vulnerable victim? So in our proposal, we'll define those as those people that are frequently unable, physically or otherwise, or very challenged in their ability to come forward and testify against their accuser. The reasons may include that their physical ability, lack of ability to communicate. That can include minor children, elders that perhaps have dementia, other people that have disabilities that prohibit their ability to speak effectively. Additionally, it includes members of our community in the vulnerable population that are coerced, intimidated, or threatened by the abuser who's abusing them. That person could be a caretaker, a family member, a domestic violence partner, or a parent. And then they may also be physically, emotionally, or financially dependent upon that person. And so they, because of the dependency, they feel like they're unable to come forward and articulate the specific words that the Court of Appeals has shown in these court decisions that are necessary in order for this the state to be able to prove these crimes. Looking at the classes of people that this proposal would include in this definition of a vulnerable victim, it would include three classes. A dependent person. This definition is coming out of the criminal mistreatment statute already, so we're just applying a statute that already exists. And then it would indicate any person because of their age or other physical or mental disability. It makes them dependent upon another person. And so, of course, that include a child. That can include somebody who's not necessarily an elder, but some other person that has a physical or mental disability that makes them completely dependent. Any elder person, so anyone who is 65 years or older, and anyone that is a victim of domestic violence as otherwise defined in Oregon statutes. So what would the language specifically that we're trying to add? We're trying to add that the definition that already exists for physical injury for all persons, again, impairment of physical condition or substantial pain, or in adding the term physical trauma. Physical trauma is already defined in Oregon statute as that it includes, but is not limited to, fractures, cuts, punctures, bruises, burns, or other wounds. The interesting thing is that where did that statute come from? The animal abuse statute. Because it has been previously determined that animals, of course, are unable to come to court and specifically say, I'm in pain, or my condition is impaired. They can't say those words. And so as a result, we have an objective standard that was already created by the legislature for animals. And that is, in theory, what we're trying to apply, the same objective standard to those who otherwise have compromised ability to say those words themselves. So just looking at these classes individually and some of the challenges that they may cover, elder abuse. Of course, again, this includes anyone who's 65 years or older. Many elders in our community may begin to develop some kind of memory, dementia problem that makes it, by the time they come to court, difficult in being able to articulate specifically a previous occasion where they may have been in pain or their physical condition may have been impaired. Many of them are...
Yes.
I'm really intrigued with this notion that anybody over 65 is a vulnerable person.
I was Senator Chair Kozanski and Representative Greenlick. I was actually warned about that this question might come up.
There might be some offense taken.
I would object to 64, by the way.
It isn't offense taken. It's the fact that you've created a vulnerable class of people who are generally not vulnerable.
And Senator Chair Kozanski and Representative Greenlick, we are trying to create some bright lines that would just allow the ability to have an objective standard for people that fall within it so that we would not have to have a hearing in each and every case that involved an elder, obviously 65 all the way up to the oldest age that exists, in order to determine on a case-by-case basis which individual perhaps had dementia, which individual perhaps had undue influence over them. And if it didn't, if those issues didn't apply to the person, there would be no detriment to somebody 65 or older by happenstance to fall into that category.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
Brief follow-up. I mean, most people, when you're talking about people over 65, you're talking about vulnerable, you're talking about people with dementia as a general thing, or another physical disability that makes them unable to communicate. You know. It would seem to me simply throwing everybody over 65 into this category is terrible social policy. And we've had this discussion with another set of statutes. You know, it would seem to me if you're looking for a bright, clear path, then you're really talking about a physical and mental impairment that may be relatively high frequency among the age, but certainly when you look at the category of people over 65 now, I'd say probably 85% of them are not impaired in any significant way. And I think it's bad social policy to go in this direction.
All right. Before
Thank
we
you,
go
Mr.
further,
Chair.
You're welcome. Get a clarification. What you have up there is basically what is already on elder abuse as to what the definitions are. It's not that because someone is 65 or older that they are going to qualify. There's other predicate that has to be shown that they're not able to articulate and for themselves because of these other potential disabilities or?
Chair Brzezinski, no. The definition of an elderly person is that is the statute.
That's what the statute calls for.
Subsection 2, subsection C, which is in the cruel mistreatment statute. There are a number of statutes that already that have enhanced penalties for abuse, whether it's physical abuse or financial abuse against those that are 65 or older, period, okay. Regardless of their particularized circumstances to their physical or mental capacities. All right. And we just wanted to mirror those statutes.
All right, thank you. Senator Gelser.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe in the abuse statutes we actually have a category that's called vulnerable adult that narrows a person that may be vulnerable based on aging practices or physical disability practices. I would have to agree with Representative Greenlick that it wouldn't make sense in a court of law if a person assaulted Representative Greenlick if he was over the age of 65 and assaulted me and we both had the same injury, that the burden of proof would be higher for me to seek justice than for Mitch just based on age. But if it was based on that vulnerable adult statute, it would narrow to that vulnerability.
And Chair Brzezinski, Senator Gelser, I think what we're trying to get at is trying to create some bright lines for both law enforcement and for the court. Because in all three of these categories, and we've only gone through the first one, all three of the categories, that same argument could be made that when you look at dependent persons or you look at domestic violence victims or elderly persons, not every single person will have the issues that I will be addressing in the next couple of slides associated with what potentially creates the dependence. And what this proposal is trying to avoid is having to litigate that issue in every single scenario. The standard of proof will be the same. The only distinction is that there would be an objective standard to quantify the injury by being able to look at the injury. So you'd have the same injury, the assumption being that someone who was not even contemplated in any of these subcategories would be able to come in and say, yes, that injury that I'm looking at was painful, or that injury that I'm looking at did impair a part of my body for a particular period of time. And we recognize that not all persons in these categories would not be able to articulate that, and if they can, that's wonderful, but that this would be available to capture those cases where they can't. But we can't know going into a case which scenarios that would be and at what juncture in the criminal process.
Okay. I've got Representative Barton and then Representative Springer following.
I'll pass. It's been said. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're on this slide, I wanted to come back here, so I'm glad that we're here now. And I'm going to try to come up with a question in this because I'm confused, quite frankly, and I'm trying to think this through. So I'm thinking of the cop that responds to the domestic in the house. First time there. Doesn't mean the first time happened. First time there. And obviously you have the mandatory arrest, which occurs in oftentimes, a lot of times there isn't a conviction that arises from there, but that law was put into place to cool the situation down and keep people safe. But by the very nature of being called to a domestic violence situation, you have now created a vulnerable victim by that very definition. So any injury, any arrest in that kind of a scenario, you automatically have a domestic violence victim by statute. Correct. Tell me what I don't understand.
Chair Brzezinski, Representative Springer, the mandatory arrest statute as currently defined requires that the officer find probable cause that either an assault in the fourth degree, menacing, or strangulation has occurred. And so that doesn't change.
Right.
So if what the officer observes does not rise to the level of criminal conduct that any of those statutes have been violated, then the officer does not have the, well, they would, if there's not a crime that's contemplated, they have no authority under mandatory arrest to require an arrest. If there was another charge, there may be other reasons that they could go forward on those. So that doesn't change anything. What changes is when the officer shows up and sees the victim with say, a black eye, and the victim says, because of all the vulnerable issues associated with her situation, it doesn't hurt, and I'm not impaired. That puts the officer in a very difficult situation, because that officer now does not have the elements, criminal elements of an assault in the fourth degree under Oregon law. And that officer then has to make some decisions that potentially could affect criminal, or excuse me, or civil liability against that officer later, because they are mandated by law to make that arrest. And if they don't, because they're saying, gosh, I don't want to make a false arrest now because I don't have these elements, but later something bad happens after they leave, they could be looking at civil liability for not doing something. But this would allow an objective standard, again, as applied to animals currently, that injury would rise to the level that the officer could objectively say, I can appreciate and understand, ma'am, why you're unwilling at this time or unable to say that you have substantial pain, not just pain, but substantial pain. I, as an officer of the law, feel that I have probable cause based on this statute to arrest the person that has criminally engaged in this conduct that's caused this injury.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I didn't articulate my question very well. I've made those arrests, so I'm pretty clear on what that constitutes and what constitutes that arrest and why there's that protection there. But if my memory serves, oftentimes, whether they want the arrest or not, the arrest is made because there's some bruising and some scratching because there's been a fight on the victim. And the victim then, because sometimes becomes not a very good witness. And so at that time, they may say, no, there was no substantial pain. And based on the court cases you cited there, there would not be a conviction, if I'm tracking.
Yeah.
Let me finish my question. There wouldn't be a conviction. Yet now, if I'm tracking, they are a victim of domestic violence under this definition, then does that change the outcome of the court case regardless of the victim's, yes, the witness's cooperation?
And Chair Brzezinski, Representative Springer, currently the state, if the state does feel that they have sufficient evidence to support criminal charges in a domestic violence case, and they have the evidence to support it through the evidence code, the state will go forward to pursue those charges. And this will allow a neutral fact finder, a judge or a jury in a trial, to make the determination based on this statute. Do they find that there's enough? And as you've heard in the previous testimony, that in all those cases that were cited, a jury convicted those people. But it was the Court of Appeals that reversed. And so it's the law that's falling behind. And so this would, at trial, if the state can support that the proper mens rea occurred by the defendant and the elements of the crime occurred, that if this injury was sufficient to meet this standard, and a jury of the defendant's peers felt that way as well, then that conviction, if it does get convicted, can be upheld by the Court of Appeals, even if the victim comes into court and testifies that, no, it didn't hurt, no, my physical condition was not impaired.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I won't belabor it any longer. I don't know that I've received a satisfactory answer yet. What I'm getting at is, I think we're good or bad. We're creating now a label for somebody based on their situation. We may like that, we may not like that. But that's the point that I'm not feeling like we're connecting yet on. So I will do some follow-up there if you could maybe chat with me. I understand the court proceeding process. I understand the arrest process. But I think we're now, it sounds like, we're saying because a person lives in this situation and this has occurred, now we've kind of changed the paradigm a little bit by a label, good or bad, of what pertains to them. So let's just leave it there and follow this up offline.
Okay. Right.
Representative Olson?
I don't.
You don't?
No.
I heard you did. Now we've got Representative Barton is going to
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to wait, but, you know, look what Representative Greenlee caused. He started it. I'd like to follow up, if I may, on Representative Springer's questions. It seems to me there's I appreciate what this bill is trying to do very much. There does seem something unsettling to me, and I think it's also what unsettles Representative Springer. And that is to say, I completely understand how, for example, a child, somebody with dementia, an elder, or somebody with intellectual disabilities who lacks the capacity to communicate substantial pain, why we would want to create a presumption. However, domestic violence is different. They have the capacity to communicate that. It's just often very difficult to get them to go through with it because of coercion and other things. That's also true of gang violence. It's true of human trafficking. It's true of fraternity hazing. It's true of many, many cases, as you guys well know. But aren't those kind of two different things and perhaps require two different responses from this building? It just feels awkward when we shoehorn them into one legislative bill.
And Chair Brzezinski, Representative Barton, I also anticipated that question as well. And I do want to answer your question, and perhaps that I have some additional slides
Great.
In this presentation where I address that issue
Thank you.
Specifically, because I do did expect that was coming.
Don't go off Great. Script, please. So if it's going to be part of your presentation, it sounds like Representative Barton's fine with that. Representative Leininger for Thank next.
Thank you so much. Well, I think that this is a really appealing proposal because the group of people we're trying to penalize are the perpetrators, and the fact that you're using sort of circumstances to persuade or not a jury of peers that, and I guess substantiate on appeal, that the perpetrator has done the thing strikes me as intriguing. I'm hearing my peers raise some good questions. I wonder if there are any other jurisdictions that have implemented a rule such as this around the country.
I can answer that. Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Leininger, I've done some research, and really all states pretty much use our definition of physical injury. What they don't have are the Court of Appeals decisions that basically say, here's what, you know, this is not enough for substantial pain, it's not enough for impairment. So it's a definition that's widely used around the country.
All right. Any other questions before we continue? Please continue.
Thank you. Okay, so going back to elder abuse, and again, not in an effort to offend any of the elders here, and in a way, we're trying to respect elders. What we're trying to do is not create a label, and I truly appreciate the concerns regarding that that issue, but we're trying to narrow what was previously a concern based on this Court of Appeals decisions to those that we feel like potentially are in a circumstance that might make it more challenging for them to come forward with that information to support the record. So again, as I mentioned before, by de facto, it's 65 years or older. These people may have some dementia issues or memory loss. they may not. But some of the other issues that we see frequently in elder abuse cases, and again, this is a vulnerable population in the sense of not necessarily all elders, but those that are in a situation that they're likely to be abused. So these are people that often may be in the older reaches of this category. They may be completely dependent on a caretaker who's taking advantage of them or a family member who is criminally taking advantage of them. These are the elders within the larger population of elders that we see in the criminal justice system as victims. And so they frequently, because of the fact that they may be financially dependent, physically dependent as far as getting to their doctor appointments, having a place to live, having any money to pay the bills, and just companionship. And this group of individuals is very challenging in handling elder abuse cases. This population is oftentimes the ones that are the least
likely to want to come forward because they see the people that are the causing the abuse, which are the ones who are supposed to be taking care of them, are the ones that are also causing the problem. So as an example, this was a case in 2011 in Washington County where the defendant was the caregiver and the defendant was charged with criminal mistreatment. And again, the victim was only 65. She had she was legally blind and had a prosthetic leg, but she was mentally sharp. So she just had some physical dependence issues on her caretaker. In this particular occasion, the defendant was arrested for hitting her in the elbow and the head. It caused bruising and intense pain that lasted a period of time. He also was reported to have spit on her and in her face and hair. In the case, there was also an ongoing record of abuse where the caregiver would do things such as hide the prosthetic leg and constantly emotionally berating the victim and made the victim very threatened by that person's behavior. And finally, the defendant pushed the victim down. Ultimately, that case was charged, and then there was insufficient evidence to obtain an indictment at the grand jury, and the case had to be dismissed because the victim became uncooperative. The victim did not want to articulate any of the issues associated with their injuries because they were so dependent upon the caregiver for their care. There are other dependent persons, as previously mentioned. The second category would include children and or people that are physically or mentally disabled, and so therefore they are what we categorize under the definition that they're legally dependent upon that person. And of course they can be nonverbal for all the reasons we've previously discussed, and for that population they are directly dependent upon their abuser for all their personal immediate physical care and supervision. And this category, they often are very much still in an emotional situation where they care very much for the person that's caring for them. If it's a parent, a relative, somebody else, they are very unlikely to want to come forward and say those magic words. And there's significant fear of retaliation.
Before we go forward, Senator Gelser?
Yes, so on the issue of being totally dependent, how would you define that? A person with an intellectual and developmental disability may not have a guardianship. They may be able to attend to their physical needs. They may not need help with toileting or walking or dressing, but they may be nonverbal. Mm-hmm. How would they fall in that case if they into this definition, mm-hmm. if they are not dependent for their physical needs, but they're dependent for safety needs or they need assistance with communication?
Right, and Chair Brzezinski, Senator Gelser, again, we draw on the definition that already exists in the statute for what is a dependent person in the criminal mistreatment statute that cites either because of age or physical or mental disability is dependent for their providing for their physical needs.
I think the concern that I have is that definition in some other places when we've looked at things around people with intellectual and developmental disabilities is not picking them up unless they are subject to a formal guardianship or they have kind of physical capacity where it's a person with an intellectual and developmental disability that may also be in a wheelchair. I wonder if you might not point to in the same way you do to elderly persons. I mean, people with an intellectual or developmental disability by definition are going to be vulnerable and but they may not be dependent for their physical needs. It's not that physical need dependency that makes them unable to articulate that level of pain or injury. Mm-hmm. It's that intellectual disability and capacity to communicate.
And Chair Brzezinski, Senator Gelser, we appreciate that comment, and that's very well taken, that is something that, you know, I think that on the face of it, I interpret this as relatively broad, that would be something that one could articulate that those things are included in this, but if that is something that, if the feeling is that the concept is a good concept, but perhaps that there are some populations that are left out, something that we could address.
I think as a bright line, individuals with intellectual mm-hmm. and developmental disabilities make more sense as an overall category than all people over 65. Because in the all people over 65, some of that population would be what you're trying to get at. In the IDDD community definition, 100% of those people would be in that situation.
Okay. And Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dale said, and I guess, again, we appreciate his comments, and that's the great advantage we have of having this opportunity to present this in advance, that we can try to work through some of those concerns. So we'll continue to do that.
I hate to do this. I'm going to ask y'all to continue. And the reason for that, one of our presenters on the next panel has to leave for court at 3:15, and I do not want to be held in contempt.
Okay. I just want to clarify. Do we have an opportunity later to address this, or are we done?
Okay. We're done. Mm-hmm. Are we done completely?
They can continue.
Yeah, you can continue. Okay. With your presentation, okay. The questioning and stuff like that. This is kind of like we're just bringing the issue up. This is just, it sounds like we're going to have a lot more communications with the members to get everyone up to speed and maybe take some of the suggestions and maybe make some modifications so we'll have an opportunity to address it in 2016. Yep. So, but let's continue with the presentation okay. So we can kind of finish up and get the overview and then we'll pick up for the next time. We have another legislative days if we need to pick up in January the same issue.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I can continue now? Yes. Okay. For just a few more minutes. I just want to make sure she's leaving. Yes. I just wanted to.
Dinah doesn't want to be held in contempt either.
I just wanted to be able to address Representative Barton's issue. And the last point on the slide presentation is regarding victims of domestic violence. So I just quickly wanted to address that issue. Victims of domestic violence, as we know, it is common to want to associate them separately as those that physically cannot speak for themselves versus people that have other issues that make it a life and death circumstance that makes it challenging for them to speak for themselves. And just we want to recognize that victims of domestic violence are frequently intimidated, coerced, or threatened not to testify or to minimize in their testimony. They're frequently very dependent upon the abuser that's causing the abuse. This was just a case out of Marion County where the defendant was acquitted at trial. The defendant had previously been convicted of harassment against the same victim, the victim being the wife of the defendant, and the defendant admits to hitting the victim in the head. The victim received a swollen side of her face with bruising. At the time, she indicated that she had substantial pain to the police, but she refused to appear at trial even after she received a subpoena. And as a result, because of constitutional confrontation issues, her statements to the police are not admissible. So the statement regarding pain was not admissible. She was in this, so the defendant was acquitted and was found not guilty. And photographs of her are in the packet of photographs that you will receive. This is one of my cases just 2 weeks ago as I was preparing for this testimony. The first jail call that the defendant made to his domestic violence victim, he basically was inquiring of what she had said to the police. He wanted to know what she said to the police and wanted to inquire, did they take pictures? And very insistently, and she's like, I don't know, I don't remember. But you remember not telling them anything, right? I don't know. You don't remember anything? And trying to impress on her that she didn't know anything, remember anything. And then finally, at the end of the call, he specifically says, you hear what I said, though, about not coming. Because, look, if you don't show up, they have no case, okay? Don't show up at all. And this happens in many, if not most, of the domestic violence cases that go through our court system. Those same victims are heavily dependent on their abusers. They're either in fear of them. The statistics show that victims who are in the criminal justice process of extricating themselves from their abuser are significantly increased in their likelihood of being killed in a domestic violence homicide. And there are oftentimes other pressures that are coming in from perhaps their church, their families, their friends. And the financial abuse is significant. Victims of domestic violence often cannot afford to be separated from their abuser. So these are reasons that they are unlikely to report initially to the police that they had impairment of physical condition or substantial pain. and or are unwilling to come to court and or are unwilling to say those words when we're in court. So finally, I think this is my last slide, the point here is that in all of these categories of people, that the state has to prove through the victim somehow affirmatively stating the words that they were impairment of their physical condition or substantial pain, regardless of how serious they are observed to be, or how much pressure that the state can prove that they're under, or how many threats were made to that particular victim, or the history of abuse that they may have previously received from that individual. All of those things are irrelevant. And I just include this photograph. We're all familiar with this. But it's just the idea that regardless of the picture, and you'll see the pictures if you go to the office and look in the folder, or see something on videotape, this case could easily be a situation where we would not be able to prosecute this in Oregon. If this victim were not to say, I am in substantial pain, not just pain, and I have an impaired physical condition, then this is not a crime. And that is something that we're trying to address. And finally, this is my last slide. The idea here, again, is that this is the language that we currently use for animals. And we're hopeful that the most vulnerable of the population of Oregon can receive the same level of protection under the law when they are being abused by an individual who has more power control over them. And this concludes my comments.
All right, thank you. Before we have any questions here, do we have questions? Because we do, what I'm going to do is recess this panel, have them come back up if we want to continue discussions. But I do, we had originally had the next panel scheduled to go second, but because of other logistics for other members, we've done kind of a hopscotch. So I want to get the next panel on, and we can have this panel come back up. If we'll do that.
I do have one short question.
So what we're going to do is y'all will step back. Sure. I'm going to bring the next panel up, and then we'll come back and have you finish up. So we'll have plenty of time. I just want to honor what we've told other people because they've scheduled. They're scheduled to be here with enough time. All right, so this is going to be a review of juvenile records recommendations from the Law Commission. Mm-hmm. Laura, thank you very much for being here, and Judge McKnight. So whoever's going to start off.
Chair Przanski and Chair Olson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Hansel, and I am the new Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. So let me just say it's a privilege to be here before you in my new capacity, and thank you for inviting us and for your time. So we are here today to talk about our juvenile court records work group, and out of respect for Judge McKnight's time, I want to just throw it to her. I have some general comments, but they're not essential.
First of all, thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. I do appreciate your accommodation. I moved my 2 o'clock docket to 4, so I want to get back from my hearing at 4 o'clock. My name is Maureen McKnight. I'm the Chief Family Court Judge in Multnomah County, Oregon. I have been on the bench for 14 years, and I'm speaking today for myself rather than for the Judicial Department, though, as my comments will make clear, I'm speaking for over 30 judges who met at our recent judicial conference to talk about this issue that we're going to address. I'm also a member of the Oregon Law Commission work group that is dealing with and has been dealing since 2013 with the confidentiality of juvenile court records. I have just a couple of main points to make, and one is that three times the effective date of a particular issue has been set over, and the reason for that, the reason it was set over in legislation, had to do with the pendency of trial court litigation on this topic, and then an appeal, and then a mandamus. And those of us who were involved in the issue of whether juvenile court records were covered by the state constitution's open courts provision, those of us who were involved in that issue were not able to participate actively in the Law Commission discussions. And there was placeholder language left in the statute. And without running through the history, the bottom line is, as of September 30th of this year, what will go into effect if we do not change that is language that says that who can get access to read, to inspect, or to get copies of juvenile court records is not only all of the listed individuals in the statute, but any other person allowed by the court. And one might wonder, well, what is wrong with that description? And even though judicial discretion one might think is the hallmark, in this particular context, the breadth of that discretion and the lack of standards is problematic. We are concerned, when I say we, I'm talking about the 30 judges who do primarily, do a lot of juvenile court work. We are concerned that that language may not withstand challenge in terms of an open courts challenge. And while the result in an individual case might be appropriate, we really felt that it would be the specification of criteria and the rigor of the analysis by statute that would have the best chance of accommodating what we have as a statutory directive to focus on best interests, but a state constitutional direction that courts need to be open, and unanswered parameters from the appellate courts about how court documents fit into that, particularly in a juvenile court context where we have so many needs to address the particular vulnerabilities of children whose location, whose paternity, whose abuse, whose parents' particular circumstances are damaging if released. And we're not talking about whether the court hearing is open. I want to make sure I'm clear on that. We're really talking, this is only whether documents are to be released. So we are finally at the point as the Law Commission of having an approach that we think does appropriately address the various interests involved, not just the child, not just the particular movement, not just the parties of the case, but also the public. And we are trying to really refine at this point to get to the exact language where we think we have the appropriate accommodations that we need. So our bill also does three other elements of cleanup, which in my mind are less significant than dealing with any other person language. And one basically clarifies that if whatever your status was when the juvenile case is open remains the status for purposes of access rights after you age out or the case is closed. The other makes clear that the court is not under an obligation to redact from the records the names of siblings or other parties in the case. And that's a workload issue, but also probably not necessary given the sibling information is relevant to the other siblings, the subject's child's case anyway. And that simply wasn't clear in the original language. And the last piece really would authorize a public entity who's investigating an attorney. This might be the State Bar, it might be the Public Defense Services Commission, to have access under certain circumstances. Those don't qualify as any of the parties, unlike DHS or OIA or the Juvenile Department that might be looking at their own staff performance. So it's really the settlement of the mandamus, by the way, was not granted, so we don't have, missing that key point, don't have the appellate guidance. So we're really left with what the consensus of the trial judges has tried to be on this issue, and we think we're almost there, and it's the desire to avoid the, as we say, the unbridled discretion that we think may be subject to challenge that prompts our desire to move this session. So thank you very much for listening to me, and I don't know if you have any questions.
So, Laura, do you have any other comments? If not, I'm going to open up for questions.
I think Chair Przanski, Chair Olson, and members of the committee, I would just want to note that our next meeting on this issue is November 30th from 9:30 to noon. All of the commission's proceedings are open to the public. We would invite anybody to come, and there are materials available on our website closer to that date. The meeting will be at the Oregon Civic Justice Center, the commission's offices, and it'll be from 9:30 to noon that day. And I would also just note that we have, since October 1st even, put about 6 hours of work in person and work groups in on this matter to craft the language, additional conversations over email, and it's a 26-member work group, so a lot of perspectives and a big balancing act to strike that balance between judicial discretion and also providing guidance to avoid potential litigation down the road.
All right. Questions for the panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, so I'm going to ask the last panel to come back up. I know that
Mr. Chair, Gina. If that is just only for my benefit and somebody stepped out, I'll...
No, I think Rep. Barton had his hand kind of going up.
You knew that, did you?
I got that motion. So this is fine.
I don't mind putting my question out there.
Okay. If I could just say, Chair Brzozinski, Vice Chair Olson, what we are really doing is not reinventing the wheel. All of our language is taken from existing statutes, and what we want to do is, I have a case pending right now, and you have pictures of that. A three-month-old baby is punched in the face by her father, and he admits it, and I'm having a struggle with even approving assault in the fourth degree, because luckily enough, she doesn't have a brain injury, concussion, or anything. It's just a black eye.
Right. So let me just, from what I'm hearing from the panel here, and I think Representative Greenlake started as to concerns as to capturing anyone that's 65 years of age and older automatically are going to fit this definition. And what I'm picking up, and correct me if I'm wrong, is possibly looking at if someone is that age, then look at other factors to see whether or not they can or cannot articulate for themselves. Because if they don't have these other issues, why wouldn't they be required under confrontation or whatever else to be able to just do that? I'm thinking that's what I'm hearing.
Exactly.
So why don't we, this is, again, first brush, and understand that we have different statutes that we're looking at. So some of the stuff that we're going to be working on, we'll have counsel basically bring us up to speed as to how these work in these other statutes. But I think that might be something that if you want to try to articulate now as to why, except for just being in line with other statutes, why that might be necessary in this particular application.
Senator Pozanski, as I indicated before, and I can follow up with information with the specific statutes that are aligned towards, that we're trying to align this with, is just recognizing, and again, not trying to create labels for anybody in a way that is disparaging, but that those that are 65 and older, and that bright line is created, sort of, we have all identified that as somebody that's a senior citizen or as an elder, as defined under the Oregon statutes, that there are other issues associated with that, which is why we have, like in the criminal mistreatment statute, that they automatically have, you know, there's statutes that associate somebody that has a crime committed against them, and they fit in that category. It's just automatic, as well as I know there's an enhancement for theft in the first degree. If you steal over $50,000 and the person is over 65 years old, there's this enhanced penalty associated with that. And there are other statutes that have that theme. So I think the idea is that it is no way detrimental to the elders, and that it, in a utmost of caution, I guess, tries to make things so that there is a bright line, so all elders would be treated equally by law enforcement when making an arrest and by the courts as the case is going through. But in theory, the idea is that the injury itself is the same. Like the case that Ms. Violence is referring to, as you'll see the photographs of, and I implore you to look at the photographs, the baby has the injury, or the person that's 65 years old or older has the injury. The only question is whether or not they can articulate pain or impairment. And that same 65-year-old person may have complete 100% faculties, as did my example in the presentation. It's just that it is possible that they may be in a scenario where they are, that person that's caused the injury, because most injuries that are caused to that population are by a caregiver or somebody that's a close family member or friend and has a proximity to that person. The statistics of them being injured by a stranger is very, very low. That they are going to be more likely to be dependent upon that person and more likely to be vulnerable and to undue influence, which would make it less likely for them to want to say the actual words that they have substantial pain or impairment of the physical condition. And so therefore, all the people that are in that, what we generalize as a vulnerable population, even though we recognize that many persons within that population are not necessarily technically vulnerable, is of utmost of caution to protect all seniors in our community, which is what our goal is.
OK.
Chair, if I may comment.
Well, first we got Representative Stringer and then Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dinah, right?
Yes.
I'm so glad you just said what you said to bring us back. This, I believe, started, this conversation started with talking about babies, because the pictures you showed us were babies. And they clearly can't speak for themselves. And I've heard a couple times now have to be able to say the actual words, substantial pain, which that blows my mind. And, of course, they can't, and there's no way they can. So I'm glad that you just said that, because it's bringing us back to the focus here. And it seems like in the effort to cast a net to catch somebody that is truly, that we would all agree, is vulnerable, that we've cast a net that's huge, and maybe including people that say, wait, I'm not vulnerable. Don't throw me in that net. So I think that might be where the real work lies, is that the net isn't too broad, and we somehow look at the population that this, I believe, I'm under the impression, really started about, and then see who those are that nearest align to that and bring them maybe into that definition. That took away your comment took away my question.
All right. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you put the slide back up where you talked about the probabilities of different conditions happening to the elderly?
This slide?
There. Is that the one that said they're
sorry.
More likely?
No, this one, yeah.
Yeah, now, it seems to me anybody of any age that has one or more of those conditions is a vulnerable person.
Mm-hmm.
And you maybe argue that senior citizens are more likely to have one of these or the other. And I would say, well, how much more likely? 10% more likely? 20% more likely? I mean, it seems to me we ought to be focusing on these things of an adult at any age. And it seems to me you would need to put forth one or more of those conditions in order to override a person's statement that no, I didn't really have pain. Yeah, I banged my head against the wall, and I'm sorry about that, but I didn't have any pain. I'm not any more disabled than I always am, which might be a bit disabled. But, I mean, you really triggered me to think about 2017 going back through those statutes. I had the same argument on the vulnerability statute of anybody over 65 for financial fraud. I think it's a problem, and 65 is not a magical number. When 65 was picked out in 1935 to be the Social Security age, it was about the life expectancy. The life expectancy is now way different, and we have a large group of people coming into that 65 age that are no way more probable for any of these conditions. And it just seems to me, as social policy, it's bad. As law, it's bad. Because you're saying, because you have a higher probability of something, not saying that you have it, but saying that you have a higher probability of it, that makes you more vulnerable. That's really weird.
And Chair Brzezinski, I represent Greenlick. Our goal here clearly is to look at, like here we have the dependent person definition. And so that does categorize the people that you're referring to that of any age that have these issues. And so those are the people would be captured here. And I think what I want to bring this conversation back to again is that we're talking about a definition that is an element of a crime. So we're talking about this would have to be in conjunction with a defendant who has been found by probable cause that they've been arrested or beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law that they have criminally asserted a particular crime. So they have the mens rea, reckless, intentional, or knowing to cause physical injury. So we're not saying that anybody that receives some sort of accidental bump or bruise, that they would not be captured within this definition. This would be somebody that was actually being charged with a crime. And therefore, under those circumstances, because of the likelihood that the person that was committing it with close proximity to that person, that dependence and undue influence issue is a frequent concern in the ability to prosecute these cases, whether that person is an elder or whether that person is a victim of domestic violence. That is a more often than not situation that comes up that is a hindrance to be able to assist the victim in finding safety and being able to hold the offender accountable and to get the offender into the treatment that would be necessary to address the ongoing situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Yeah. Any other questions? Senator Thatcher.
And then and Barton was in there. And me.
Very patiently waiting.
Again, okay. Yeah.
Well, I just want to bring it back to I just want to make sure I'm understanding. It sounds like the law that we currently have is substantially similar to most other states. Okay. But because of court cases, the intent of that law is not necessarily being met. Is that a correct summation what the situation is, and that's why this is what we're trying to fix?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment, really, which partially repeats my previous comment. I really appreciate where you guys are coming from, and I'm happy to work with you and try and get this ready for February. I, for one, have absolutely no reluctance to create the statutory presumption with respect to the element for issues of incapacity, children, disabled people, senior citizens. Actually, unlike some of my colleagues, I don't have much of an issue with the existing bright line rule of 65. I think it served us very well in the abuse of vulnerable person statute right now. It's fine by me. To the reason I am reluctant then to shoehorn domestic violence into this, where there is capacity, but it's difficult, I get that. I see these as distinct issues analytically. Both good issues. I'm happy to have the conversation about both. But one thing about the domestic violence is something that I think this committee knows well, is that to the extent we create this domestic violence exception, where there is a capacity issue, it's just difficult. It will be a few years from now when other issues try to expand that to other crimes. And we know that because it happened with hearsay. For example, there is a hearsay exception to domestic violence in Oregon, and that is often attempted to be expanded upon. For example, and again, it could apply equal force to gang activity. Really, any time you have a defendant and a victim kind of in a close social network, social financial network, that there's that social pressure. And I totally recognize that it makes your job really hard, and we want to help you. But there's a balance to be struck there, and I don't like conflating it with the other issue, which is one of capacity. Again, I'm repeating myself. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Senator Gilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate the work on this, and Senator Modest Anderson and I were in another committee the other day that referenced this. Our civil child abuse statutes actually reference the criminal code definition of assault and physical injury. So where in this context we're talking about who is going to go to jail, these definitions also significantly impact when protective services are able to be offered to a child. I think we've all had circumstances where we've seen pictures of children that have been injured or harmed and don't understand why protective services have not been able to be offered. These definitions applied in a civil way are one of the reasons why.
Mm-hmm. All right. Representative Linger, you had your hand up earlier, so I'm not sure if you had one.
Thank you. Yes. I appreciate the need for as bright a line as we can help you get because of the administrability of this work, because it costs a lot and it takes a lot of time if we have to have a mini trial on every person's capacity, and we can't sometimes use brighter lines. So I think that that's a valid consideration. I think I wonder if we can address the concerns people have about, it seems to boil down to undermining the credibility of victims by having them end up in a certain classification, though our intention is good, if we have the capacity for them to somehow overcome the presumption that their lack of testimony or their contrary testimony is untrue, because I think that there's a lot of value in what you're trying to do. So could we cure the concerns that some people are raising by having people be able to refute the presumption that they're less credible than someone else might be by doing, we just essentially shift the presumption. It seems there's got to be a path forward for us to get done the work that you're trying to advance. Is there a question? I don't know.
No. Yeah, sure. I think this is a work in action.
Vice Chair Leininger, trying to respond to that category. This does not in any way affect the evidence code or any of the hearsay provisions that already exist under the law. So, for example, in the one example I gave in the case in Marion County, the challenge in that case was that because the victim was threatened or coerced, did not come to court, even though she had been subpoenaed. And so that puts the state in a challenging situation. That in that situation, he had been convicted of harassment against her before, so there was a documented history of abuse. And in that situation, you can see the observable injury to her face. And she tells the officer she has a pain of an 8 out of a scale of 10. But when the case goes to court and she's not present, the evidence code prohibits her statements to the police officer from coming in because of constitutional Sixth Amendment confrontation issues. And so, therefore, the state is left with this photograph of her injury. And under the current analysis, under the Court of Appeals, that just looking at something, whether it's a video or a photograph, and saying, that looks really bad, that's an injury, to a common sense standard is insufficient. And that we would have to have that actual testimony in court. Now, hypothetically, if she had come to court or been physically forced to come to court, and even if she had in court said, no, it didn't hurt, there are some hearsay provisions, as referenced by Representative Barton, that I'm very familiar with, that would have allowed the officer to testify that she had at the time said that it was a pain of an 8 out of a 10. So that wouldn't change anything associated with the evidence, other than it would, her physical presence would allow additional evidence to come in. Some of the, what more of a concern is, not as much in court, assuming that the victim appears in court, which frequently they don't, as is evidenced by that case, but is the initial report. You know, whether it's a child abuse case or an elder abuse case or a domestic violence case where the police are called to a scene, maybe by the victim, maybe by a friend or a neighbor, and they see somebody that has what appears to be a very, you know, bruising cuts, you know, these type of injuries that appear to be, within this definition that we've proposed. And they look at it, but then the victim, again, because of incapacity, fear, threats, or other dependents are like, no, it doesn't hurt. No, I'm fine. I'll be fine. And then they're left with, that's their statement.
Right.
That's the evidence that the state has to go forward. But again, ultimately, it would be a fact finder of a jury or a judge that would also look at that evidence to say, yes, our community believes that this rises to the level of physical injury at a common sense standard, and it meets that definition, which again is already applied to animals in the state.
Let me just ask a question on the Marion County case. Mm-hmm. Based on the representation that the victim had been subpoenaed, why didn't the state move to get a continuance and compel her to testify or come before the court if she was properly served and that could be shown?
And Chair Brzezinski, I communicated by email with the DA, Jillian Fisher, who handled that case in Marion County. Regarding the specifics of it, she indicated that first of all, a subpoena was mailed to her, and then it was followed up by an investigator from the Marion County District Attorney's Office who then contacted her there. She, in essence, shut the door in her face. They left the subpoena there, indicating you've been served on her property. I guess arguments could be made whether that was an official personal service, but regardless, just for a moment, let's assume that it does meet the criteria. That takes the case to the next level, that it is judicial discretion about whether something could be continued and the outcome may or may not be any different. The only other recourse for the state, which is very unpopular, is to hold that victim in contempt and have the victim arrested and brought to court. And I can tell you that that happens sometimes. It is not favored to do that in there. And so, as a public policy matter, that's not popular. Yeah. And so there are many jurisdictions that would opt not to do that under those circumstances. And that's to the detriment of finding all the information that could be found if that witness were to come to court. But that shows the degree of you know, reluctance that that person must have had to come forward to be able to provide that testimony. And again, that's why we seek to avoid scenarios like that where we're forced to make those kind of difficult decisions, especially with someone that's been previously held accountable by the criminal justice system for domestic violence. We, with this tool, it becomes a non-issue.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you for coming
back
up.
Thank you.
So our next panel is going to be on the criminal liability in bicycle and motor vehicle collisions. We have a number of individuals. So I don't, if all four of you, Jeff, does everyone want to come up? If you do, we need to bring another chair up.
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Leininger, and Vice Chair Spruce isn't here anymore. Members of the committee, my name is Jeff Rhodes, and I'm a Deputy District Attorney for Multnomah County, currently serving as our legislative liaison. I am joined by Chief Deputy District Attorney Chuck Sparks from my office, and Julia Corkett, who is a Multnomah County citizen, as well as Amy Joyce from the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm thrilled to be here to speak with you today about fixing a significant gap in the law with regards to criminal liability. And here we have it in the context of bicycle and motor vehicle collisions. However, this would apply to non-motorized vehicles, pedestrians as well. And for context, we were asked to speak with you about this sort of specific scenario, and I have a specific scenario that I'd like to pose to you that we can use as an example as we move through the provision of the law that apply in this scenario. So we've put together this PowerPoint to assist with that today, and I want to start you off with a scenario that it's an incident in Portland. It's a very busy intersection, and it's a spot where a lot of bike traffic occurs, especially during the rush hour time. So what I have for you here is an aerial map of what we're talking about, and imagine, if you will, this is 11th and Hawthorne in Portland. And you can see, I don't have a laser pointer here, but you can see on the bottom of Hawthorne Boulevard, there's a big green square there. That's a bike box. And you can see on the right-hand side of Hawthorne Boulevard, a bike lane running that whole length. Now imagine that bike lane full of folks coming to and from work. That gets very busy. Also, you have Hawthorne and 11th there. 11th is running north-south, and that is a very busy vehicular street.
So just for clarification, the green bike box is what you're talking about. That's on the street for where bikes line up for the next intersection. Is 11th Street the intersection where that green bike box is located?
That's correct, yes. Okay. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, that is correct. That is the intersection that we're talking about. So, and what happens at that intersection, Mr. Chair, is that cars are oftentimes driving down Hawthorne Boulevard. They'll make that right turn onto 11th, and they do it while bike traffic is continuing. So you can imagine that folks are having to look behind them and see if bikes are coming before they make that right-hand turn. There's a lot of pedestrian traffic. Suffice to say, it's a very busy intersection. So I thought it was a very good example for our case here. So, and again, this is a an example scenario. This is not a real case, and so that's what we have here for you. Let's say, for the sake of argument, this occurs on Friday, 7:30 p.m. It's October. We've got a typical Oregon rainy day. Our defendant in this case, he's coming home from work, a happy hour work party, consumed two drinks. We always hear two drinks, but this is actually two drinks in this case. He's driving an SUV. Our victim is cycling home from work late, wearing reflective gear, and has lights on his bicycle. As I stated how this intersection works, the defendant is about to turn onto 11th Avenue. He's making a right turn, properly signaling and waiting for pedestrians who are oftentimes traveling across that intersection. And the victim is riding up on the right-hand side. continues into the intersection and anticipates continuing down the bike route on Hawthorne, and right as he enters that intersection, our defendant executes a right-hand turn. He's been waiting for the pedestrians to go for a little while, a little bit heavy on the gas, a little bit frustrated with having to sit there, and does not see that cyclist coming up on the right-hand side. The victim is struck by the vehicle, suffering multiple serious injuries, and his left arm is severed and must be amputated. So, after the incident, the defendant remains at the scene and is cooperative. He fails the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, and for those of the committee that aren't familiar with this, this is a test that we give in DUII investigations. It's an eye test, so if you've ever seen where officers will have somebody follow what we call a stimulus back and forth, that's what this test is. It tests for involuntary movements of the eye, which may determine impairment. And so, it's field sobriety testing, is taken to the precinct as a result of failing what we call the HGN, and he takes a breath test. The result is a 0.04 BAC, which is, of course, below 0.08, a legal limit, but certainly relevant to our analysis in this case, and we'll get more to that later. Defendant tells us he didn't see the cyclist. It's twilight, and didn't see those lights coming his way, although the bicyclist did have lights on his bicycle. A defendant has a few recent traffic infractions on his record, and the victim is seriously injured with permanent disability. He was wearing proper bicycle lights at the time of the incident. So, with that, I'm going to turn it over to our Chief Deputy Chuck Sparks in my office, who's going to go through our charging decisions and some of the laws that would be applicable in this case, but keep that example in the back of your minds, and then I'll be back to kind of finish up the presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Leininger, and members of the committee. I'm Chuck Sparks. It's my pleasure to be here and to expound a little bit on how we go about our business when it comes to a major crash. For just a small amount of background, for 9 years I supervised our major crash team in Multnomah County, and so all fatal and serious injury crashes came through me. I carried a pager, and I would get the page whenever it happened. And the way we do it in Multnomah County anyway is to send a deputy district attorney out to the scene so we have eyes on everything from the very start. We build better cases and make better decisions, and obviously it helps with the cooperative effort that we want with our police partners. So with that in mind, obviously the first thing with a motor vehicle that distinguishes a mere accident, something that was completely unintentional and while it may be civilly culpable, is not criminally culpable, is a mental state. And so we're very interested, when we get called to one of these scenes and somebody's been killed or seriously hurt, to figure out what our mental state is, and that is sort of the first step in deciding if we have a crime, and if so, which crime is it. The four mental
Mr.
states.
Chair, excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Can I ask
a
question? In fact, I'm trying to keep it in my mind. I have a question. Was the bike coming from behind the car or toward the car?
Chair Przanski, Representative Greenlake. Actually, if I go back, it might be good if I just point things out
same
on
direction.
The overhead.
It's
would
the
that
same
be
direction.
Your assistance?
The same
direction. That's what I assumed. It was overtaking. The bike was overtaking.
I actually ride through this intersection all the time. I'm a bike commuter, and I live in Southeast Portland, so I come across the Hawthorne Bridge, pass the county building, salute the commissioners, and then go on my way home. And we have Hawthorne. Can everybody see you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hawthorne is eastbound here. It's one way. Mm-hmm. And the bike lane is striped in green, and then you have a box, which is something that Portland does to give the bicyclists an evident right of way. It allows you to move in front of vehicular traffic, which is all moving eastbound, and to put yourself in front so that you're effectively taking the lane and you're not going to be run over inadvertently. It helps avoid exactly the type of circumstance we're talking about here, because it's much less likely that the person will make a right turn over the top of you if you're sitting in front of that person at the start of the turn. 11th Street is southbound here, and
This up over here is Ladd's Addition. You can actually see the angled approach to Ladd's Addition. So many actually will go straight. Some will go make a right turn here. You can see the continuation of the bike lane. This is just for emphasis in light green. So all vehicular traffic is going in this direction eastbound. The bicycle traffic is in the bike lane right here, occupying perhaps the bike box and either turning right here or continuing on and turning into Ladd's Addition. I think in our scenario, it's a right turn onto the left.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Okay, so Chuck, really quick, where was the vehicle or unit number one that locate that you're given that scenario?
Correct. Our impatient driver, as the scenario plays out, the bicycle is actually not out in the box in the lane, but running in the just general bike lane and is making the turn here. Right. And the car is coming up here and making a right turn over the top of the bicyclist. Now, the bicyclist had been going straight. The bicyclist, somewhat counterintuitively to some drivers, has the right of way. So if the car is ahead of the bike and the bike is coming along in the bike lane, and to make the turn, the car has to turn over on top of the bike. The car has to give ground and yield to the bike, which is why in Portland, it's with the density of bicycle traffic, it's very important to look to the right before you actually make a right turn, which those of us who grew up before there were a lot of bikes on the road weren't used to looking into our lane to the right and back before we make a right turn. So that sets the stage. So the mental states that really apply to the crimes that we use in crash cases are recklessly, which is by far and away the most common, and with criminal negligence. The reason recklessly is the most common is we analyze sort of three bodies of evidence or three types of evidence. We look at intoxication, we look at bad driving, and we look at what I call attitude when I'm training police officers or DDAs. An attitude doesn't mean you failed the attitude test with the police officer. Attitude is what I refer to, or is my sort of shorthand for a body of evidence that the courts in this state over the years have built up as reflective upon the mental state. So when we analyze whether someone is engaging recklessly in their conduct towards another person, we want to know, for example, if that person's intoxicated. Nobody would probably disagree here that driving a motor vehicle while intoxicated is a reckless act. And the courts have said that. Simply being under the influence of intoxicants by itself is reckless. Bad driving by itself can be reckless. And we've all seen drivers where you just shake your head and think, you're going to kill somebody if you keep doing it that way. And so you have the high-speed lane changes and people who are driving at high speed in high-density areas where there's a lot of pedestrian traffic exceeding the speed limit. We all know that sooner or later something really bad's going to happen, and those people are engaging in reckless behavior just based on their driving. The third category, attitude, generally happens after the crash, and the courts in this state have permitted juries to hear evidence of the person's mental state as it is displayed after the fact of a crash. Now, it's generally not 2 days after the crash. It's right after the crash. And so when someone who is, let's say they're intoxicated, they're engaging in bad driving, and they hurt somebody seriously or they kill them, you want to know, was that person behaving recklessly or perhaps, as we'll get to in a moment, recklessly and under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life? So recklessly or super recklessly, I don't give a damn, is sort of the shorthand for the latter. And when you're looking at that type of behavior, you can consider, for example, did the person commit a hit and run? Because few things evidence a just cold-hearted disregard for somebody's well-being if they hit them and then they take off and leave them lying in the street to fend for themselves and maybe get hit by the next car that comes along, get run over. Well, nobody would question, I think, that a jury hearing that would say, boy, then your driving that led to the crash was reckless because you were aware of and disregarded a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the circumstance existed or the result would occur. That's the definition of recklessness. So the behavior after the fact, for example, engaging in an allude with the police after it happens, or just getting out of the person getting out of his or her car and lighting up a cigarette and not going over to check on the victim. We've had that happen. Having them lie about, were they driving? They try to blame it on someone else. Somebody jumped. Somebody else was driving. I wasn't driving. They try to hide the car. They fight with the police when the police are engaging in an arrest. So that's a summary of some of the evidence that we see when you think about attitude as reflecting back on the mental state. So, and you can see the importance of sending a deputy DA out, generally in the middle of the night, to explore these options, because we want to find out firsthand what do we have, so that when we bring it to a grand jury and a grand jury can make its charging decisions, that grand jury has everything, and the DA is there to sort of be the receptacle, to gather up that evidence as it unfolds. So the criminal code, then, is what we are looking at when we take a case into the grand jury, and of course you're all very familiar with grand jury, and the process of advising the grand jury means that we explain to them what the law is as we bring the evidence in and present all the evidence. We usually give them sort of a snapshot of potentially applicable statutes up front, and then on the back end, when they've heard all the evidence, we go over the statutes again so that we answer any questions they may have, and we also answer questions, of course, during the presentation of the case. So I'm going to go through quickly just some of the statutory provisions that apply in what we call crash cases. First of all, a criminal homicide, common sense, is taking in one person taking another person's life with one of the relevant mental states, and it then falls into the categories of the various crimes mentioned in number two. It's manslaughter in the first degree with when it's either committed, a person takes another life recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, or the person is a recidivist driver who has, on this occasion, under the influence, taken a life while driving a motor vehicle, and on a prior occasion had at least three prior DUIs, or had one of the three versions of a felony assault involving driving a motor vehicle. So that's manslaughter in the first degree. Generally, the one we see most often is not the second one where you have a recidivist, it's the first one where somebody is intoxicated and they're engaging in behavior recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference. An example of that, just a quick example that's probably the most horrific example I've handled, was an individual who was a .16 driving his Cadillac Escalade through the blocks. He blew a stop sign in a 25-mile-an-hour zone, driving past people loading their kids into vans and things of that sort because it was a Saturday afternoon. At 66 miles an hour, he T-boned a car with a 90-year-old woman and her 55-year-old son. He killed both of them. He bailed out, and he ran. So he did everything that could possibly satisfy extreme indifference in taking those two lives. Manslaughter 2 is taking another person's life recklessly, so you peel out the extreme indifference. Recklessly always involves the potential of intoxication, but not necessarily. So you know you've got it if the person's intoxicated. You may very well have it if the person is engaging in other behavior. For example, the one I just talked about with the Escalade at 66 miles an hour, if that person had not been intoxicated and had stuck around afterwards and done everything right, but still blew a stop sign at 66 miles an hour in the blocks, that would at the very least be recklessly causing the death of another person. Criminally negligent homicide. We don't have as many of those because, as you can imagine, the reckless mental state is almost always involves checking the intoxication box. Because when we have these crashes, it's pretty rare for someone who's engaging in this kind of driving not to be intoxicated. Occasionally, we do have the bad driving, but usually it's such bad driving that nobody would say it's negligent, because criminal negligence is a failure to be aware of a risk, whereas recklessly is aware of and consciously disregards the risk. So criminal negligence is a lower standard, but it's an important one, and it's different from civil negligence because it has been defined in the 1973 Criminal Code legislative history as essentially I won't get the quote exactly right, but a studied indifference to the rights of others. And indifference to the rights of others, not aware of the risk and ignoring it, but just indifferent, not caring enough to even look and see. So criminally negligent homicide, not as common because most of these crashes involve more serious conduct, but some, when you need it, you really need it. Sometimes you do have it. Aggravated vehicular homicide, I'm going to speed up because we could spend too much time on these, is a recidivist who previously has committed a vehicular homicide, so it's the second vehicular homicide. Now we're moving into assault. These are definitions. They're pretty straightforward. A motor vehicle under number three is a dangerous weapon under Oregon law. Assault in the first degree. Intentionally, we don't have that in these crash cases. Very rarely. Sometimes it will be true, but we're not here to talk about the intentional cases. Really, the and then you have the recidivist who has any one of the six, the vehicular homicides or the prior serious vehicular assaults, or has three prior DUI convictions, and we do have those, but they're fairly rare. Assault two, the third bullet is probably the one that's the one that's most significant. Recklessly causing serious physical injury to another by a dangerous weapon under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference. Assault three, if you back out any of the critical elements of assault three, two, you end up with assault three. So if you back out serious physical injury, make it physical injury, you've got assault three. If you back out extreme indifference and make it mere recklessness, you're left with assault three. It's enhanced to a B felony if there is, and this is not in the text, but if it's got to be serious physical injury and the person's intoxicated, then it's a level 8, not a level 6, which is the sentencing guidelines level for most assault threats. Assault 4, it's basically what you're left with when you just have person A injuring person B. There doesn't have to be any sort of weapon involved, and sometimes we end up there. Generally, and in fact, the proposed statute in this case would be a helpful substitute, if you will, because sometimes we end up with an assault four if we can prove recklessness, but if we have criminal negligence, we can't even get there. And then some of these other statutes are simply applicable, and I'll just scroll through them. Hit and run includes what we call felony hit and run, where someone does a hit and run and leaves someone behind who's seriously injured or killed. So I believe Jeff's going to give you the details on the pedestrian and bicycles.
So obviously, the laws that apply to bicycles in our particular example are incredibly important, but thinking back on our example case and the laws that we've just looked at, it starts to look like that there's not very much that can cover this scenario that we're talking about. The argument would be regarding recklessness. Does it rise to recklessness or not? Of course, one of the things we'd like to look at is the criminally negligent homicide statute. However, the victim did not pass away in our example case, and that is the exact scenario we're going to be getting to later. But with that, it's important to just know a few quick things, and I only have, a slide or two on this. What is the application of the traffic code to bicycles? And the answer is basically all of it. This provision, 814.400, states that every person riding on a bicycle is subject to all the same provisions applicable to vehicles, basically unless it becomes nonsensical to make that application apply. So, and then, of course, there are very specific portions of the vehicular code that apply to bicycles themselves. And I've listed a few of them out here. I didn't want to go through them all, but there are rules regarding using the bike path, signaling, what you can put on your bicycles, clinging to cars while you're riding your bicycle as well. That is not legal, as fun as it might sound. In our example case, however, we had somebody that had lights on their bicycle, they're using the bike lane, they're not clinging to another car, so we don't have any issues here, but just to have some context. So this is where really the rubber meets the road, so to speak, is crime victims' rights. Why is this so hugely important that we need to address this scenario? And the answer is crime victims have very specific rights under Article 1, Section 42 of Oregon's Constitution, and we want to make certain that victims are able to avail themselves of those rights in very special cases, in cases where they need to do so. In this particular case, in the example that we have, it starts to look like the argument's going to be, was this reckless or was this not reckless? And there's an argument to be made there. We had somebody that had two drinks, coming from a party, but they were below the legal limit, right? And so they had signaled the turn properly. There's some good driving and some bad driving. This is one of those gray area cases. And it's a case where if the victim had died, we certainly would be charging a criminally negligent homicide. That's what we'd be looking at doing. But in this case, the victim was just maimed to the point where they lost an arm. Now, that's not just a just. That is a huge life-altering injury. And we need to make certain that these provisions of the code apply to these people that need to avail themselves of these crime victims' rights. So with that background, this is our Oregon Crime Victim Bill of Rights, and I'm not going to read it to you or make you read this wall of text. I think it's in the materials that are provided to the committee, but this next slide is what's really important. What is conferred upon a victim in these cases? The right to be informed of and present at all critical stage proceedings, of course, that's important. But the second point, the right to prompt restitution from the person that caused the injury, did the criminal act, that is a hugely important constitutional right for crime victims to be made whole. Imagine what you're going to be going through having lost a limb for the rest of your life. Having restitution from the person that committed that act against you, that criminal act, that's a very important thing. And just because somebody didn't perish and lost a limb, that shouldn't be, they should not be able to avail themselves of the right to prompt restitution. And then we also have transparent court proceedings to be informed of all rights as soon as possible. I think I've belabored the point why this is important and why we were here before you today discussing this. So here is our proposal to deal with this exact scenario, and it's to make certain that crime victims suffering serious physical injury, which is defined in our law already, we're not creating new provisions out of whole cloth, as a result of a traffic crash are adequately protected and can avail themselves of those Article 1, Section 42 rights. And this is our proposal. It's criminal negligence when an incident with a motor vehicle causes serious physical injury to another person, ranked as assault in the third degree, and it would be as a crime severity 4, which the intention there is to recognize the seriousness of this conduct, but also if you take a look at the criminal guidelines grid, that would be difficult to enter into a spot where that person was going to prison for this particular conduct. What we really want to get at is making victims whole. That's what's really important here. So here is the language that we have. A person commits the crime of assault in the third degree, and this would be in addition to many other provisions that exist in statute for assault in the third degree, with criminal negligence, causes serious physical injury to another by means of a motor vehicle. It's a very limited provision, just by means of a motor vehicle, so it's not going to be expanded into any place that we're not trying to get to. And as I said, serious physical injury is already defined by law. There is a wealth of case law regarding what is serious physical injury, and we'd be relying upon that to prove these charges. And again, the sub 2 here is the crime severity category. So I think we've hit on this, but our rationale for it is we really want to fill a significant gap in the law, not to restate the point too many times, but just because a victim does not perish as a result of one of these incidents doesn't mean they shouldn't be able to get restitution from the person that committed the criminal act against them. So we want to make sure those victims are protected under Oregon's Constitution while not appreciably increasing the prison population by making it a crime severity 4. So this is our slide here with our contact information in case any questions come up with the committee. But with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Corkett, who's here from Multnomah County. But I'm here to answer any questions the committee has.
Hello. Chief Prozanski and Vice Chairs Olson-Liniger and members of the committee. My name is Julia Corquette, and I'm a resident of Multnomah County, and I'm also the mother of somebody who was injured in a very similar accident. It sounds eerily familiar to me. On Mother's Day this year, my son called me at 7 o'clock in the morning and woke me up and said, "Happy Mommy's Day." It was a bright day, the sun was shining, and I knew what he was going to be doing. He was out biking before work. And he went for miles and miles and miles because he loved biking. I got a call from one of his friends 3 hours later, and he was in tears saying, "Julia, there's been an accident, and it's bad. It's so bad. It's as bad as it can be." And he was crying. I was with my elderly aunt, and I said, "Excuse me, I really have to go." And I made it to OHSU after the ambulance had arrived this time, because this is the second time Alistair has been hit by a car driving recklessly. The first time I was able to run down the hill and say, "You have my son." This time, when I asked the ambulance drivers, "Where's Alistair?" they just looked at me and said, "You need to go in there. Somebody will talk to you in there." And when I went in, they had social workers waiting for me, and they all looked at me with this very serious, sad look on their face, and they were there to help, but that doesn't make it any easier. And I said, it's bad, isn't it?" And they said, "Yes, it's very bad." And I thanked them for their time and said, "What I need to do now is to see Alistair." And they allowed me to go in and see him. And the doctor said, "Make sure you talk to him, tell him he's going to be okay. He might be under, but he'll hear you." And so I did. I told him he was going to be fine. He was strong. And he is strong. He's an incredibly strong person. That accident would have killed most people. He's alive because somebody had a rope in the trunk of their car, and they ran and grabbed it and tourniqueted his leg right then. He was sitting there looking at his leg across the road. And on the way to the hospital, the ambulance drivers did not give him any medication. Alistair remembers the doctor coming out and saying, "So what's he on?" And they said, "Nothing." And the doctor started yelling at them. Alistair's not in a good place right now, but he doesn't like to think of himself as a victim. He goes to his brother's birthday party and he dances with his crutches. He has not been able to get his leg yet, but he will get his leg. It was a terrible thing. His leg wasn't amputated, it wasn't cut off, it was ripped off by somebody with a car with a modified bumper. And he's wondering whether he'll ever get back on a bike again. But he wants to. The last time he was hit by a car like that, he had 100 stitches in his mouth and his teeth were capped. And he said, "I'm scared. I'm scared to get on a bike again in case I get hit again." But he did it, and he worked so hard. And now he's going to have to work even harder. So I thank the district attorney of Multnomah County for making these steps to help people like Alistair, because he's only a representative of other people who have been hurt and who might be hurt. So thank you.
Thank you. Amy, you're here. Did you have some testimony, or are you just here for questions?
Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I was contacted to come in and bring some data. ODOT is sort of the keeper of the data on crashes, and so I was asked to come in and provide some information about the numbers of these kinds of crashes that occur. So In terms of fatalities in bicycle collisions, we define that as a person who's the bicyclist who dies within 30 days of the crash. For 2015, obviously, our data isn't complete, and in fact, it won't be complete until about July of 2016. But we do keep track going right along week by week for preliminary data. And so far for bicyclists in through November 15th of this year, we've had four people who have died in bicycle crashes, and which actually is an improvement over 2015, in which we had five as of this date. This is a reduction, obviously, and actually is the only statistic that's going in that direction. All of our other fatality data is up this year and up significantly. Mm-hmm. That is fatalities. Obviously, we're talking more about the serious injury, what we refer to as an A-type injury, incapacitating type injury. And for those, we go back to 2014, and in that year we had seven fatalities total and 65 A injuries across the state. 2013, three fatalities and 61 A injuries across the state. And I can go back 10 years if you prefer, but we range from the three in 2013. There were 15 fatalities in 2011, 15 in 2007. In terms of A injuries, our range from a low of 37 in 2010 and a high of 94 in 2006. None of these reflect fault or errors on anyone's part. They're pure statistics of fatalities and A injuries involving a bicyclist. So that's what I have at this point, and I can provide any number of other data that the committee would like regarding this issue.
All right. So before we take questions, Ms. Corkett, I want to thank you very much for coming forward. I can only imagine it's not easy to tell your story about your son in front of a bunch of people you've never seen before. But I will tell you that you being here will and does bring it home to us as to real victims, real matters, real issues for us to be looking at. So thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
All right.
I appreciate
any questions or Representative Olson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I like to ride a bicycle. Fortunately for me, I do not do it inside the city. Yeah, I mean, and I get it. When I do, occasionally, once in a great while, it's like I'm always on the defense, always. But Jeff, Chuck, I guess my questions are directed towards you on this whole thing. My first thought on this is that the law requires all those who are on the public roadway, whether it's a pedestrian, bicyclist, motorcyclist, motor vehicle, that they have to operate with due care. And I'm looking at the criminal negligent statute and how it is written. The one part toward the tail end, I'm wondering how you would dovetail this into this. Is you don't have it, I don't think. It's actually 161.085 is what I'm looking at for what the definition of criminal negligence or criminally negligent is. But I just close with this last piece on this. It's a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in a situation. I throw that out there at you mainly because of the scenario that you were describing. I get exactly, you know, Chuck, how you were describing everything because I just understand that. But I'm thinking, given the description of what the scenario was, how does that apply in that? And I know what you're wanting to try to do in your recommendation for the statute or for change. How does that play out? Because I'm struggling with that a little bit.
Chair Brzezinski and Vice Chair,
you can move the mic.
Yes,
there you go. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Olson, thank you for that question.
Well, you've actually put your finger on it. This is not, and Mr. Rhodes mentioned, it's a sort of a gray area case, and that actually describes a lot of cases that we handle in this area, because you've got the category of cases that are clearly criminal, and you've got the category of cases that when you take them into the grand jury and you hear testimony, it becomes evident that this should not be criminally charged. Sometimes the driver will actually testify upon advice of counsel, and will extend that invitation, and under the law, we now have to extend that invitation in certain circumstances. What I would want to do in this case, and I, the example is good, but it would just be a starting point for the conversation. As the DEA going out to the scene, if that were me, I would want to know exactly what this individual said about what he had done. I would want to get a better sense of, was he buzzed at all? Because when Jeff talked about .08 being the legal limit, that, well, we all say that, but that's actually, strictly speaking, not true. .08 is the level at which nobody may drive. Everybody's under the influence. I could be under the influence and probably would be, shouldn't be driving at a .05 and perhaps at a .04. But let's dial it back a little bit further, make it an .03, mm-hmm. something like that, where you've got some degree of lack of awareness contributed perhaps by the consumption of alcohol. Two drinks in an hour, I think we all understand that that's going to have probably some impact depending upon who the person is. So we'd want to take a look at that. We'd want to hear testimony about that. We might, for example, have a recorded interview with the driver, mm-hmm. Which would be the protocol in the Portland Police Bureau's approach to this. We would record the driver's statements. We'd want to have a good understanding of what the visibility was. And a lot of the cases I've analyzed with the crash team, because we all do it as a team effort, is what's the backdrop? What's the visual backdrop? How much would this driver see? From his vehicle, how much would he see? The A pillar, the B pillar, the C pillar, the support posts in the car, what do they block? Does he know, has he driven that car before? Does he know that it can block him or not? So you would really, frankly, get into the weeds and get your facts as clearly understood as possible. So this is not a no-brainer assault three, if criminally negligent driving resulting in serious physical injury were to be a crime on the books. It would be a scenario that would trigger the inquiry. I think another example that we're all familiar with, that I don't know about you, but it drives me crazy when I see somebody texting or surfing the web as they're driving along. And that, you know, you could have the thought, well, there but for, you know, a few facts go I. But and we're not trying to scoop up and bring everybody into the indictable cohort, if you will. What we are, I think, attempting to address is people who are very distracted and simply not concerned about the fact that other people are being placed at risk. The situation with Mr. Corkett, without going into the details, was such a situation. And the more densely populated it is by human beings who are out and about on bicycles or on foot or any other means of unprotected transportation, the more you look at the possibility that somebody who seriously hurt a person or persons has in fact engaged in criminally negligent behavior causing serious injury. I think it also bears mention, if I can be permitted to make this observation, that where the case goes, if there's no statute like this, because there's no analog to criminally negligent homicide on the assault side of the ledger, it drops down to careless driving, or in this case with a bicyclist, it'd be careless VRU, vulnerable road user, under 811.135, which is a traffic violation. It's a beefy one. It's the most potent one out there, but it's still a traffic violation. It's not a crime, and it doesn't seem to account for the behavior, and the victim loses a lot of important rights and the ability to be vindicated under the law.
Okay, follow up. Yes, thanks. So, I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier about attitude, you know, and descriptions of all what that is. I mean, and again, I again understand that. Where do you go with a situation like this if all of a sudden, and this is your measurement for attitude, the driver who is the defendant, all of a sudden, who committed the crash, just says, oh, I'm sorry, I did not see the bicyclist. What happens then?
You would look at, and that happens. Mm-hmm. And we, as you can probably imagine, there have been many cases where we haven't charged in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. First thing we're going to look at is, was the bicyclist doing everything right? Was the bicyclist visible? Did the bicyclist have lights on? This one in our hypothetical did have lights on. I'm pretty brightly lighted, mm-hmm. and I do that as a defensive measure, not because I want to be able to have my estate sue the guy who runs me over and kills me. I do it so I don't get hit, and it's a very effective tool. Do they have any reflective striping on their bike or on themselves? Were there any distractions in the environment that would cause a driver not to be alert or not to be alerted to this situation? But were some of the distractions things that are well understood and people should behave more carefully? For example, if it's raining, we don't see as well, obviously, if it's high noon on a beautiful July sunny afternoon. So I would go into it and ask, was the bicyclist doing everything right? Did the bicyclist do anything to put himself or herself in harm's way, or a pedestrian, or a person on skateboard, or whatever? And then I would ask, what was the driver doing? And did the driver do anything that shows essentially a callous disregard, so that under the criminal negligence definition, 161.095, we would say that the failure to be aware of this risk constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care. And juries decide that. Grand juries decide that, and criminal juries. And when I instruct my grand jury, I step out of the room. And they make that decision. And sometimes they do things that I disagree with. Been known to happen more than once. But I don't tell them ahead of time. And so the call is the grand jury's call. And they obviously use the standard as the conscience of the community, the standard of the community's judgment, which I know you know that. But that's So to answer your question, there are no easy answers that I can just sit here and say, oh, that's... Yeah, I mean, you could construct scenarios that are easy, but when you get one that's on the line, those are cases where we're much more likely to say, you know, this case we just need to take to grand jury to see what we have. So I, as the prosecutor, know, and I might pull it back from grand jury. I might say, okay, now I've seen more, and this doesn't warrant a felony charge, and we're going to withdraw it. Or we present it, and then the grand jury makes their call.
Thank you. All right. I represent Greenlick.
Thank you, sir. I don't drive anymore. My wife drives, and I watch and navigate. And the thing that scares me the most is a bicycle is coming up from the rear. And in this scenario, take away the alcohol. The alcohol is 0.00. And now you have a driver that's pulled up, is trying to figure out what to do with that green box, and dealing with the right turn. He's waiting for a right turn. In your scenario, the driver was waiting because there was a pedestrian in front of him. While the driver's waiting, the bike has come from a block away with lights on, but also seeing the driver with a left turn signal on. And it just seems to me, I mean, what really frightens me in this scenario when I'm helping my wife drive, and she drives very well, is that you're waiting for the pedestrian. It was clear the last time you looked. You've been staring at the pedestrian, and now the bike is coming pretty quickly with a green light. And that accident seems almost inevitable. I mean, every time I'm watching, well, she's watching the pedestrian. I mean, it seems to me, except for the alcohol piece of that, it seems to me it's very hard to think that a driver acting legitimately could have gotten into that mess and injured that bicyclist. And I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. So, I mean, I'm not sure what to make of this situation. I guess it's not a question. It's just, it puzzles me. And it's a situation that I really worry about. Because we're in places where we live in Portland, Northwest Portland, where we're constantly dealing with four pedestrians, three bicyclists, and trying to make a right turn before the light goes. And it's really, as a driver, I think very frightening. And I'm sure from a bicyclist, it's terrifying.
You've made some important points, and with the chair's permission,
I'll reflect briefly on some of the points you made because they're important ones. Mm-hmm. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, and Representative Greenlich, thank you for bringing that up. I do the same thing, and particularly when I drive through Northwest Portland, which I don't do that often because I'm a Southeast guy, and it scares me to drive up there just because it's the parking alone is more than I can afford.
Come early Sunday morning.
But the I know exactly what you're talking about, and you've in your concern scenario backed out a couple of critical elements, though, I think that are extremely important. First of all, the fact that your wife, I doubt, would drive after a couple of drinks, and
absolutely not. Yeah, I'm saying let's assume there's non-alcohol involved.
Right,
and then it still could happen.
Well, I think you're describing an accident in that case, and there are a lot of cases that you add just one or two facts, and those are critical facts, and you add the fact that in the scenario, the person also romped on the gas because he was impatient, and you'd have to be able to prove that. We know that because we wrote the scenario that way. But on the investigation, you would have to have persuasive evidence that pushes past the 50-yard line, past the 20-yard line, and across the goal line on that issue. Did the person actually accelerate rapidly, impatiently, into an intersection that's populated by pedestrians just moments ago and wasn't looking? Because the other thing is, if you're on Hawthorne driving in that area and being a bicyclist there all the time, I can tell you all the cars know that the bikes are there, and all the bikes know that the cars are there. And so you have to use due care. I think it was Representative Barton earlier who made that point, that everybody has to exercise due care. So you've described an accident. If you add back in the drinking, I won't call it intoxication, but he did fail the HGN, and the impatience and the rapid acceleration into the populated intersection, and then you go from mere accident through negligence into criminal negligence, which is a disregard, sort of a studied disregard for the rights of others. And that's why juries are there. I mean, I don't need to lecture this committee because this committee is responsible for the juries in our state and the way our laws look. So as this committee knows better than anybody, the function of that jury is to be the bellwether and to make the tough calls and to find all the facts. I also think it's important and would suggest respectfully that while the scenario we hoped would be helpful and would trigger conversation, obviously this committee will make any decisions about what is appropriate and where to draw any lines. This is our starting proposal, if you will. And I also think that there are other examples, but the facts that you include some drinking, which can lead to some inattentiveness and some what we would call criminal negligence in how one is driving, or some aggressive driving that's simply no intoxication, but aggressive driving, which your wife, I doubt very much, would do. And if I may be permitted to make that observation. And the example I used, the potentially of texting or on the phone, I have to say, when I ride my bike and I see somebody next to me at that intersection or near to it, and they're looking on, they're updating their social status, and I'm just thinking, great, I really have to be careful. And I've also told my mom, personal story, she is 85, she's a great driver, has no problems at all, but I've said, Mom, you've really got to look to your right and back. Every time you make a right turn, you just have to do it, because she hasn't quite gotten used to that yet, and she's going to kill me if she finds out I use this example, but it's true. So if she were to do something, I think it would be an accident. The scenario you've described, I think, would be an accident. There are lots of very sad accidents out there that the criminal law has no answer for, and we're not asking that be so. It's just there's some situations when you gather all the facts carefully, you put them in front of a grand jury, the grand jury says, yes, that's criminally negligent. That young man lost a limb because of criminal negligence, and then a trial jury gets to sort it out, or a judge, not
the DA's office.
Let me give another perspective on this. I mean, I think what we're really focusing on is, and what we should be focusing on is the conduct of the driver, the person that's the suspect in this case. And we look at the threshold we have for criminal negligence, and Representative Olson brought this up, it has to constitute a gross deviation. And so that is a real big filter. I mean, it really, really is. I mean, most of you know I cycle a lot. I've had many friends who've been hit, killed, and seriously injured. And when you look at the scenarios, there are some that we think would have fit this definition if that was a tool in the toolbox, but many, many others where they don't. Yeah, and so it's one of those things we can't really, I mean, it's like, is there something missing in our statutes that would allow for those individuals who meet that criteria of deviating grossly over the standard that we have that are currently not held accountable to the level they should be because we just don't have that tool there?
I worry about that attitude too, so because I could imagine if I hit somebody in that case, I get out of my car and there's somebody laying with his arm somewhere else. Yeah. I could become very odd. I mean, odder than usual.
There's a lot more to this as to what potentially the civil side, as to hearing that the bumper was altered. I mean, you know, what was that? And is that something that that person should be held on a civil side? Clearly you could paint a picture that criminally it could be something that was a weapon type of offense. But those are things that, you know, cross over.
Thank you for bringing this. This is, I think, a very interesting
discussion. Well, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I wanted to point out, Jeff, in your slides early on as you teed up the scenario, after I think you teed up the example, and you referenced the Constitution and the right to restitution, which is obviously a good thing and something that I respect and hold very dear. But I just want to bring us back and remind us that the criminal process is not the only process for restitution. In fact, it may not be the best. In my opinion, it's not the best process for restitution. So we don't have to change a law if the motivation is restitution, because restitution is already available there. So I'm still confused on... I get the culpable mental states piece, but we're actually looking at using the civil definition, the civil code definition of negligence.
No.
Chair Brzezinski.
Clarify that for us.
Representative Springer, if I may address the first point. The fact that restitution is a constitutional right, I do think, is an important distinction between the civil process and the criminal process. There isn't a constitutional right to receive remuneration through the civil process, but a victim who suffers a criminal act is constitutionally protected. They have the constitutional right to be made whole by the person that commits that criminal act against them. And respectfully, I do believe that is an important distinction and something that when somebody, and I keep coming back to the example of had somebody perished in that example, we would have criminally negligent homicide available to us, but just because they lost limb, we don't have that avenue available to us. In my estimation, those crime victims are every bit as deserving of those rights under the Constitution as other victims, as other classes of victims.
So to my question about negligence.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Olson, and Representative Springer, members of the committee. There's a very different standard. Mere civil negligence is an assignment of fault based upon someone's social duty to perform certain functions or engage in certain behaviors in a responsible manner. And so their failure to do that, and they can actually assign out comparative fault so that if both sides are to some degree at fault, but one is 75% and the other is 25%, then a 75% payoff to the person who's 25%.
I'm getting in over my head here because I'm not a civil lawyer, so I'll stop on that. But criminal negligence is defined at 161095 and also further defined in the legislative history to the 1971 code. And I, as you can imagine, in the work we've done in the major crash team, we see lots of cases that are accidents, even though terrible outcomes, somebody dies, sometimes more than one person dies, and it's really horrible. And those are some of the toughest conversations we have, is meeting with families and telling them that the criminal case is not going to proceed any farther than grand jury. We'll usually take it to grand jury almost always to make sure we know what the facts are. But criminal negligence is a much higher bar than mere what we call garden variety negligence, and the cases involving mere negligence are not criminally chargeable, nor are we suggesting that. Really, what we're suggesting is an analog under the serious physical injury side of the ledger for assaults, an analog to criminally negligent homicide, which we've had in the code at least since 1971, and I suspect long before that. And we've used that criminally negligent homicide statute. We frankly don't use it that often. Probably the most common occurrence is when we plead a manslaughter in the second degree down to a criminally negligent homicide as part of negotiations. But they are occasionally pleaded and proved, and that I suspect would be similarly true here. And if I may, Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Olson, just to talk briefly to Representative Greenlick's point about acting odd after a crash, if that were to happen. The attitude is we're talking about somebody who is aggressively and unquestionably unfriendly or hostile to the victim's circumstances. And we had a case where, for example, an individual drove a car into a group of people standing in front of a bar. Two people lost limbs right there. And the individual got out and she lit a cigarette and, when told what had happened, didn't care and said as much. That's the kind of thing, or leaving somebody in a hit and run, or engaging in a lewd, fighting with the police, none of which you would do, none of which would fall into that category. And I probably use a wrong, attitude isn't the right word for me to use. I should probably say other behavior post-crash would be a more neutral term that would be less likely to have negative connotations. But thank you for raising that issue.
I have one other question, I believe, from Senator Yeltsin.
So this came up in the testimony and then in the questioning. What is a modified bumper? I Googled this. I can't figure out.
The car comes with a bumper, or does it come with a bumper? And it sounds to me like this individual had a different bumper system, meaning they took the original one off and they put something else on that would not necessarily be certified as a bumper.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it's a deviation from what either came on the vehicle or
the goofy thing about it is the law doesn't require a vehicle to have a bumper. That's right. The goofy thing. So you can do anything you want to, you know, for any type of a bumper device.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, add to that a little bit, since I am from SIO, and everybody does something to their bumpers in SIO. We're talking grill guards, we're talking, it's usually not so much the bumper as a grill guard, and then the grill guard encompasses a bumper. I had one on my patrol vehicle that was completely legal years ago in Grant County because we took out deer all the time, and it was cheaper than new grills and radiators. So when you see trucks usually with a lift kit driving around, not always, and you see something coming around, we're really probably talking about a grill guard more than we're talking about a bumper, is my guess.
And I think
it encompasses sometimes the bumper portion also.
And so I recently had a communication from my community about somebody driving around with modified hubcaps that had giant metal spikes on them, and the concerns about those metal spikes grabbing bicyclists in the bike lane as they went down if there was
I don't know about those.
I didn't know if that.
Yeah.
It was Corvallis, not SIO.
Yeah, we don't have
all
those.
Right. So if there's not other questions, I want to thank you all for coming forward and bringing and introducing the topic. I expect that we'll see more of this in the near future. Thank you very much.
Thank you to members of the committee for hearing us.
Yeah. Colleagues, before we conclude, I do want to just kind of make an announcement. I've worked with the president's office, and just let you know, because of the situation that we dealt with UCC Umpqua Community College, we're going to have a special hearing that will be set. It appears it's going to be in December
on December 17th, which is a Thursday. The purpose of this hearing is basically to look at these type of situations as to what can we be doing as a state as to trying to prevent it and the prevention, what happens during the event itself, as well as after the fact. And this is basically to be applied across these type of situations. Clearly, we know that we've had four in this state in recent time. And so this will be one. I've indirectly have spoken to Chair Barker. He is also very interested in this issue. He will be available on the 17th. And I believe he is in the process of asking for the speaker to allow for the House to also be part of that committee.
It will be here at the Capitol.
It will be at the Capitol, and Chana is working. More than likely, will be this room. We will be making invitations to other committee that have interest in this area. This is one of those scenarios that is not limited to one application, as you can imagine. Having not only schools involved, also having the town center. And so what we're going to be looking at is how have we reacted. I will tell you, unfortunately, because of the situation that happened at UCC, we have learned that some of the protocol that we have as to how these cases are required to be investigated, the process and procedure, I personally feel that we need to relook at this for we can actually ensure that we're being as efficient as we can and getting information out to those who have potential impacts either and such. So it's going to be very broad. It's over genetic stuff. We will be bringing different people in with different expertise that can give us information on how things played out. And this is not to be critical of any particular part, but what is it that we as a state can do better than what we're doing now? So with that, excuse me, Representative Springer.
Thank you. Will this be invited testimony only?
It will be. At this point, it will be an invited testimony. We are expecting, we're scheduling for at least 3 hours. If things go as planned, we're looking at starting at 9, and we will plan to go up to noon. And if depending on how it goes and depending on what the interest is, we may continue into the afternoon. This is one of those scenarios that it's upon us, and it's just, I think, something that we need to look at to see, are there things that we can do that will make it better in the sense of outcomes under the situations that these events create. So with that, I want to thank everyone for staying as long as you did, and we will be adjourned on the Senate side.
Andy. And we are adjourned on the House side.
Here's some pictures.
Huh. I don't want to clip her. Thank you.